Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with parents who have started a foundation to fund childhood asthma education, treatment, and prevention in Ohio schools. He'll also talk to a doctor with the Alzheimer's Association about new research, and we'll hear from some experts about vehicle safety. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
The Lung Association is offering free resources and scholarships to health professionals here in Ohio. This is thanks to new funding from a local family who lost their son, Reed, to asthma complications in 2020. Now, according to the Ohio Health Department, more than 163,000 children in Ohio are currently living with asthma. To change those outcomes, the funding will help create new health scholarships. It's also going to fund a backpack program that provides school supplies and education around asthma management and control. Glenn and Mary Wiley, Reed's parents, join us now on Columbus Perspective. Thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Good morning, and thank you.
First and foremost, I want to express our deep sorrow for your loss.
Thank you.
How old was Reed when he died?
Reed was 28 years old and living a wonderful life in Akron.
As a child, was he sickly with asthma?
He was. Thank you for asking. He was diagnosed at a very young age. And with asthma, there also part and parcel comes with eczema, allergies, all of these three work together. So he was diagnosed, I would say, around a year and a half. And we just struggled trying to find the right blend of medications and how to balance dealing with this disease.
At the time of his death, did he develop COVID or pneumonia, or was the death the result of an asthma attack?
No, it was not COVID or any other thing other than a fatal asthma attack that put him in cardiac arrest.
And he was in good shape.
He was in good shape. He was an athlete. Reed played very active from childhood till he was 28. He played hockey his entire life. Very competitively. He played for the University of Akron for 5 years, played some men's league hockey after that, but he was a very active, healthy boy other than he had asthma, but he was educated and he knew how to manage it. He had albuterol inhalers that he carried with him constantly for minor flare-ups, and he even had a portable nebulizer machine that was with him in his home. If he traveled, he would take that with him, so he always had his medication at the ready.
What toll did asthma take on his cardiovascular system?
Well, it's hard to know because we weren't necessarily watching and measuring that because he was so young. We felt his heart was in good shape, but that was ultimately what caused his death was cardiac arrest.
Parents who are listening to this, myself included, because I have asthma and I have a child who has asthma, it's very concerning to hear these stories. And the most important thing we want to know is what can we do as parents of asthmatic children to keep them safe?
I think one of the most important things to understand is what triggers your child's asthma or your asthma. We go from allergies, being it seasonal or year-round, change of temperatures. Reed was very susceptible to the change in weather, going from the hot summers to the cool falls and cold winters. Staying involved with your children and having a wonderful relationship with your primary care physician, your pediatrician, and even the school nurses, as they play such a vital part.
And it shouldn't be limiting for what your child can do. As we indicated, Reed played hockey. He was very active, and every child and every adult can be very active. It's just making sure that you've got the knowledge of how to address an asthma attack and, you know, what should be done every day to manage that asthma.
The two of you chose to create a foundation to help with this issue. Was that a choice that you made immediately following his death, or was it a choice that was made after reflection?
It was a choice made after reflection. We took a few months after Reed's passing, and we still grieve to this day, but we wanted to do something to keep his memory alive. So we created the Reed Wiley Charitable Foundation. That happened probably 9 to 12 months after his passing. And since then, we have an annual golf outing, and we have raised close to $250,000, which we give back to the Lung Association for the asthmaohio.org.
How difficult was it to write that mission?
It may sound odd, but it was somewhat therapeutic. This entire journey with the Reed Wiley Charitable Foundation is a sort of a labor of love. We certainly have our moments and our memories that make us cry, but the work that we're doing helps balance that. And all of the educational resources that we have for school nurses it's absolutely incredible. You mentioned the backpack program. We're offering stock albuterol for schools so that if a child has an asthma attack and they don't have their medication, the school has medication so they can make that asthma attack manageable. We've got education for school nurses, such as the Open Airways program, Kicking Asthma. They've got flip charts available for school nurses to educate young children. And all of it is free and funded by our foundation. And all of this information can be received or obtained at asthmaohio.org.
Asthmaohio.org. Glenn and Mary, I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk to us today about this most important issue. And I know how difficult this must be, but rest assured you're doing a good thing for the community in his memory.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us today.
For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
In Columbus, it is estimated that approximately 236,000 people age 65 or older have Alzheimer's disease. That's more than 11% of that age group's total population. The Alzheimer's Association estimates 1 in 13 people aged 65 to 84 and 1 in 3 people aged 85 and older live with the disease nationally. Early diagnosis, a desire for treatment, and a willingness to take risks to slow the disease are among the new findings of a new Alzheimer's Association report, where new state data highlights the prevalence of the disease, mortality rates, and also the cost of caregiving. Dr. Elizabeth Edgerly is the Senior Director of Community Programs and Services at the Alzheimer's Association and joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss the report. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
What did the new Alzheimer's Association Facts and Figures report uncover?
Well, what we saw yet again is Alzheimer's disease continues to have a significant impact, not only on those who've been diagnosed, but also on their families and the country. For the first time, we are now at over 7 million Americans living with Alzheimer's. That number went up by 300,000 in the last year alone, so we're at 7.2 million nationwide. And right alongside them are 12 million family and friends serving as caregivers. So, Jay, with those numbers growing, you can imagine the cost costs have grown as well. So this last year, we spent $384 billion on Alzheimer's care, $24 billion more than the year before.
So what's happening in our Buckeye State?
Well, in Ohio, as you said, there's 236,000 people living with Alzheimer's, really a shockingly high number of people. And there are family and friends as caregivers, there are 450,000. So when you put those numbers together, it's hard to not know someone impacted by Alzheimer's or as a caregiver when you're living in Ohio.
One of the things that we learned this year in our research is that there could be a possible correlation between PBMs and Alzheimer's disease. Did the report reflect any new insight into that issue?
No, that wasn't a focus of this particular report. What we really looked at more was attitudes around diagnosis and treatment. But maybe for a future for a future report, we'll look at that too.
I'm sure we want to know the cause, but what's the climate like among folks that have to deal with this? How are they feeling?
You know, for a long time, we've really avoided looking at Alzheimer's or getting a diagnosis. And what we saw in our new report is that Americans are actually very open. 90% have indicated in this survey that they would take a test, like a blood test. And overwhelmingly, they're interested in finding out if they have Alzheimer's early, ideally before the symptoms occur or while the symptoms are mild. And the reason for that is they want treatments. They want treatments that could slow the progression or improve symptoms or even learn about lifestyle changes that might help to maintain their brain health.
What is the prognosis for someone who is diagnosed with Alzheimer's prior to it actually manifesting?
Is when someone is diagnosed early. Now, and currently the way it works in your doctor's office is first you have to have some symptoms. But if you have mild symptoms, what could happen then is you may be eligible to take one of the new treatments that have come available in the last couple of years. And those treatments clear out a protein in the brain called beta amyloid and potentially give the person more time to function at that higher level where things are still very mild. And that's what we hope for. We really hope that people can extend the good years that they have. They don't work forever, and of course, we're hoping for more treatments of this type in the future that will tackle different culprits in Alzheimer's. But ultimately, what we see is if you're diagnosed earlier, you have access to different types of treatment than if you're diagnosed later.
Is fear the factor that is preventing people from getting tested?
Fear is definitely one of the things that is a factor. It can be really scary to think that someone has Alzheimer's, but that's not the only factor. Sometimes what we see is people have a hard time differentiating, well, what's just normal aging and what's something I should be concerned about? And they also need to be able to talk to their doctor and have that doctor take them seriously and start to examine whether it could be Alzheimer's or something else that's causing a significant issue.
There are lots of OTC advertised treatments for memory loss and things of that nature. Has the Alzheimer's Association looked into the efficacy of these treatments?
Well, we don't specifically look at the impact of over-the-counter treatments that are advertised, but really what we focus is on the science and looking at things that are FDA approved. So we always urge caution. The ads sound great when you hear them, but sometimes you want to just make sure that they were studied in a careful way. So, you know, I always tell people to look at things, take it with a grain of salt, and be careful. Make sure that you're not going to do something that could have adverse consequences. So I always recommend people talk to their doctor if they're considering one of those over-the-counter drugs that sound really good, but may not be the right fit for everybody.
One of my doctors cautions me to stay off the internet because I have a tendency to self-diagnose. But there's got to be a place where you can get some real answers to real questions. Where is that place?
Yeah, actually, I highly recommend going to the Alzheimer's Association's website, which is ALZ. www.reed.org. And there's so much rich information there. So if you have a question about research, you can find it. If you're concerned about, gosh, if what I'm seeing in myself or in others might be a warning sign or a red flag, go to ALZ.org, and it will provide you with lots of information that has been carefully vetted and curated, so you can feel confident in the quality of that information.
We want to thank Dr. Elizabeth Edgerly from the Alzheimer's Association for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
It's time to start planning those annual summer road trips. Sabra Cook and Madeline Stewart are here from the Porsche Carrera Cup. They join us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss seasonal road trip tips and safety. And we thank you for being with us today.
Hello. Thank you so much for having us.
It is our pleasure. So what do we need to do to our vehicles to make them, quote unquote, road ready for these seasonal trips?
Well, it's really important that you are prepared leading into your road trips. And one of those things that you can do is to make sure you are running the right fuel in your vehicle. So Exxon and Mobil offer Synergy Supreme Plus fuel to their everyday drivers, which is the exact same fuel that both Sabre and I use in our Carrera Cup cars when we race. So this fuel keeps your engine 3 times cleaner, which improves efficiency and performance.
Do we need to change the grade of fuel we use or use additives to enhance engine performance?
No, with a Synergy Supreme Plus fuel, that is all you need. It keeps your engine 3 times cleaner. It has everything that you need to make sure that your engine life runs longer and is more fuel efficient.
What are the risks that could potentially occur as we take a road trip? Because most road trips, the short ones are maybe 100 miles, but the long ones could be as many as 1,000 or 1,500 miles. What kind of things could occur while we're driving?
Well, you always want to be prepared for the unexpected. The way you can also be prepared is making sure that you have as little distraction as possible. So when a challenge comes up, you can have full focus on that. So that means having the route planned out before, not messing with your phone, no scrolling, as tempting as it may be, and try not to mess with the music too much, kind of preset it. So that way when a distraction comes up, you can be ready to handle anything. Make sure you have the right things in your cars, like maybe a first aid kit, snacks, obviously, those are essential.
Very important.
I think snacks are essential just in general, but that's just me. What about tire air pressure? I know that based on the time of the year, the air pressure changes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So inside of your driver's door, there is a little sticker that should have the tire pressures that you need to run on your vehicle. So unless you've changed your vehicle in some way, you should use those tire pressures as your base point. So fill it up to that pressure. I sometimes myself like to go a touch over it because I hate when I get the tire pressure alarm. But if you use those standard pressures, you should be good to go. Just check them regularly. Do notice that when it does get hotter outside, your tires can get a little bit higher in pressure, but they will cool back down in the evenings when the temperature drops. So checking them regularly is all you need to do.
The Porsche Carrera Cup happened at the beginning of the month of May in Miami. More events are planned this summer. How would you describe the Carrera Cup? Is it a road rally? Is it a race? What is it?
The Porsche Carrera Cup is a championship that runs around North America. So we run at 8 different events throughout the year, 5 of them being IMSA races, and 3 of them we race with Formula One. So we were at the Miami Formula One Grand Prix. The Carrera Cup is a championship that also runs around the world. So you have the Porsche Carrera Cup Australia, Germany, and France, etc. It is a highly renowned championship that is very competitive, and it is a fantastic platform for drivers like us to gain recognition and move up the ranks in the sport.
How did you guys get started in racing? What age were you when you knew you wanted to do this, and what were the steps you had to take?
I started about 7 or 8, and I think Maddie started at about 9 years old. We both had dads and grandfathers that were involved in racing, and so we were pretty much born into it, but we took to it pretty early on, and I think I'm sure Madeline is the same as me. I just fell in love with it right away. I was obsessed with my dad's motorcycle. And as soon as I was able to drive my own go-kart and kind of get into it, I was there for it.
Would you say the same thing?
Yes, absolutely. So I had an older sister that started about a year before I did. So the two of us raced together growing up. It's very much a family sport. You can't do this without your family. And so it's something that we would go away and do every weekend, and I just loved it. And I didn't always know that I was going to be a race car driver. It's a real privilege that not everybody gets to have. So I feel very lucky that I get to be doing this. I've traveled a long way. I grew up in New Zealand and then raced in Australia, and now I'm here based in the US. So it's a long journey, but it's also a really amazing one.
Here in Columbus, we have a problem with people thinking our interstate highways are racetracks. Where is a safe place to go if you decide you want to engage in that kind of acceleration and performance with an automobile?
Well, a great place would be to go to any of the Porsche Experience Centers around the U.S. You can go get your fill. There will be awesome instructors there taking care of you and making sure you get acquainted with the cars and you feel confident in going into high performance. So that way you can be more focused and have more capacity when you go back to your daily driving. But please, no racing on the street.
Exactly.
We do not condone.
What is the best online source for drivers to plan summer road trips and to understand some of the tips that we've given them today?
I would go to Exxon.com, and it will also let you know future race weeks for the Porsche Carrera Cup coming up. Don't miss out on the 3x extra points that Exxon Mobil Rewards Plus members can get during our Porsche Carrera Cup race weeks.
All right, we want to thank Sabra and Madeline for being with us today, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
$2.5 billion for infrastructure. Voters gave it a resounding thumbs up on Tuesday. Issue 2 passed with 68% of the vote. This means the state capital improvement program is renewed for another 10 years. But what does this all mean for you? Well, here's what it will do. The state will have the authority to issue $250 million worth of bonds per year for 10 years. This is all for local municipalities across the state. The capital improvement projects can only be for roads and bridges, wastewater treatment systems, water supply systems, solid waste disposal facilities, and stormwater and sanitary treatment facilities. State leaders tell me this will not raise taxes. The program was created in 1987. It was renewed in 1995, 2005, and 2014. So voters have now renewed it for the fourth time. Municipalities apply for low-interest loans and grants through the State Capital Improvement Program. Since the program was created in 1987, supporters say it has provided funding for more than 19,000 infrastructure projects in all 88 counties. They also say it generates 35,000 construction jobs. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle say this will help make sure both sides of the road are in good shape.
It's the fourth time we've reauthorized it. It is very important for our local communities for important infrastructure projects, so I was glad to see the voters support it.
And the people who are administering this, county engineers and county commissioners, sit down and say, okay, here's our share of this. What do we really need to do?
The State Capital Improvement Program will now continue from 2027 through 2036. Democratic State Senator Herschel Craig co-sponsored the bipartisan legislation to put this issue on the ballot with Republican Senator Brian Chavez of Marietta. Craig emphasized the passage of this measure does not cost Ohioans more.
This does not, and we said that clearly, does not raise your taxes, but it is fundamental to the infrastructure and what it will do for our roads, bridges, waterways, all of that.
Joining me now to talk about the impacts of Issue 2 and how the State Capital Improvement Program works is Franklin County Chief Deputy of Engineering, Fritz Crozier. Fritz, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Doug.
So what is the feeling amongst the engineering community right now that, you know, that this has passed and the project will continue?
Excitement. We're very excited to see this funding continue for the next 10 years. Franklin County Engineer's Office, like so many different agencies around the state of Ohio, have a limited funding budget. So Issue 2 will help us bridge that funding gap. It will help us deliver critically important infrastructure improvement projects to the residents that use these roadways and bridges every single day.
I was going to ask that. You know, how important is this to the local municipality?
Very important. As I said, with the limited funding that we do have, we're always very aggressive in seeking federal and state grants. We utilize these grants to leverage other grants. So it's critical to have access to these funds so that we can continue building our important projects.
So what kinds of projects does it fund? You have some that are actually in the works right now.
Absolutely. Roadways, bridges, drainage improvement projects, water supply chain facilities, wastewater treatment facilities. Some of the important projects that the Franklin County Engineer's Office has received some of this funding for in the past include a multitude of roundabouts throughout Franklin County. A couple of examples of those are the Norton Road at Grove City Crop Road intersection in southwest Franklin County, Morse Road at Babbitt Road roundabout in northeast Franklin County, bridges, Hayden Run Road over the Scioto River was built a couple of years back utilizing these funds. And currently, we have a couple of ongoing projects that are under construction. Those include the Treby Road over the Scioto River project.
That's funded through this project.
Absolutely, yeah. That's right there just west of Upper Arlington. That's a bridge project. And we also have a roadway project ongoing in the Hilliard area. That's the Renner Road Improvement Project from Alton and Darby Creek Road to Spindler Road.
I know the Treby project has been underway for quite a while, almost from the top of the hill all the way down.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a multi-year project that began construction in late part of 2024, and we're hoping to wrap that up early next year.
So what do you think would have happened had this measure not passed?
Unfortunately, many of the jurisdictions throughout the state would have been faced with some challenging decisions. We would have had to reevaluate our capital improvement programs, and unfortunately, we would have been faced with decisions such as which projects can we advance, which projects might need to be delayed, and unfortunately, we probably would have had to cancel some of our future projects.
Do you know typically, it's $250 million a year. Do you know how much Franklin County averages in yearly money that comes in for these projects?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that this is it's an annual program. It's competitive. The Franklin County Engineer's Office has been successful on nearly two dozen projects over the last 5 years. But because it's competitive, some years we'll be successful on one or two projects. Some years we'll be successful on maybe a few more. We also submit applications on behalf of the townships throughout Franklin County. So any given year, we might, as I mentioned, we might be successful on two projects, or we may be successful on six or eight
projects. Does that depend on the size of the project and the cost?
These projects are scored and ranked based off of a multitude of factors that include the existing condition of the roadway. They take a look at safety and health, economic development potential, and also the projects and the scoring for these applications typically take a close look at project partnerships. Are we working closely with other agencies and other private partners?
How does it work then? So who makes the decision on who gets the grant or the low interest loan? How does that process work?
So it's a very well-run process from our experience. Again, it's an annual grant program. The Ohio Public Works Commission is responsible for administering the state capital improvement program. As mentioned, this is a program that provides financial assistance for infrastructure, and it has grant components and 0% interest loan components. The fund is paid for by bonds issued by the state of Ohio, which require the voter approval, most recently here on the May 6th ballot. We submit projects and applications every single year to our districts. There's 19 districts throughout the state of Ohio. Franklin County's district is District 3. And for those components of the applications that I mentioned previously, they'll take a look at all of those factors that I had mentioned, and they'll score them against other agencies in each individual district and rank them appropriately.
I mentioned that this project, this program has been around since 1987. This is now the fourth time voters have renewed it. How much impact has this had over those 40 years across the state? And I understand it's all 88 counties.
Right. I think the statistics, they speak for themselves. I believe the number is something like 19,000 projects over those 40 years. In just the last 5 years alone, our office has received over $16 million. That's absolutely essential in order for us to continue delivering the projects that are on our capital improvement program.
The current round of bonds is still in effect. So we report that this goes 2027 to 2036. There's no gap here this current round of funding is still going on. So you mentioned some of those projects that are going on. So is that application process still going on for the current round of funding?
Yes, absolutely. So what we love about this funding program is it's quick to deliver the projects. Typically, if you receive a successful grant application, you're seeing that project go to construction in 6 months, maybe upwards of 18 months. But every year there's an annual application process. We're actually beginning the conversations at our office currently for this fall's application cycle. And typically the announcements are made by the Public Works Integrating Committee by the end of the year.
So it's a constant process.
Absolutely.
Then. And what are your hopes for that next 10 years?
We're very aggressive in trying to reach every corner of the county. Franklin County Engineer's Office is intent on serving every single resident every single day, and we have a very aggressive program. I think we've got over 80 projects on our capital program, and there's absolutely no way we'd be able to deliver that program without funding like a state capital improvement program.
Yeah.
We're just eager. We're excited to see that the voters of Ohio responded with a resounding yes this week, and we're very, very excited to deliver these projects for the residents we serve.
Yeah, Columbus gets a lot of attention, of course, but you're trying to hit every municipality in the county.
Absolutely.
All right. Fritz Crozier with the Franklin County Engineering Department, thank you so much for your perspective on how this all works, on the ground level. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
President Trump announced a trade agreement with the United Kingdom. He said the deal would include billions of dollars of increased market access for American exports, specifically agricultural products. Trump said the U.S.'s 10% tariff on U.K. goods will stand. U.K. Prime Minister Keir Starmer says the deal will boost trade between the two countries. Britain says the deal will cut tariffs on U.K. cars heading to the U.S. from 27.5% to 10% and eliminate tariffs on steel and aluminum. They add the agreement sets a quota of 100,000 UK vehicles that can be imported to the U.S. at that 10% tariff. I asked Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno if he believes it's a good deal for the U.S.
It's a phenomenal deal for the U.S. It massively expands agricultural products going into the U.K., massively expands natural gas going into the U.K. from America, two things that we do a lot of really well in Ohio.
On that same day, Moreno urged U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick to expand tariffs on steel derivatives to cover the cost of imported appliances that are made with steel. He says that would help American appliance makers and workers, such as Whirlpool in Ohio.
So think about this. At one point, not that long ago, all appliances in the world were made in America, for the most part. All of them. We had General Electric, Westinghouse, Maytag, Whirlpool. We were the absolute kings of the hill on making appliances. We have one company left, Whirlpool. Where do they make their appliances? In Ohio. They employ thousands of people in five different manufacturing facilities, key facilities for these communities. And they have to compete with slave labor in China, Chinese steel that is massively subsidized. So what I've asked the president to do is when those appliances come in, that the entire appliance, which is mostly steel, by the way, get tariffed at the 232, which is the emergency tariff rate of 25%, to allow Whirlpool to compete.
The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell announced the Fed is holding interest rates steady. Powell said the decision was based on economic data showing the U.S. is relatively in good shape. He also said the Fed wanted to wait until the effects of President Trump's tariffs on inflation and economic growth are clearer. That prompted Trump to call Powell a fool for acting too late to cut rates. I asked Senator Moreno about the Fed's decision to hold interest rates steady.
I think that's a wrongheaded decision. Look, at the end of the day, there's certainly room to lower interest rates. You've seen other central banks around the world do the same thing. Very disappointed with Chairman Powell. He committed to me in our conference meeting in the banking committee that he would stay apolitical. During the Biden administration, he stayed silent as fiscal stimulus went out of control, which led to generationally high inflation. He knew that was bad policy, but he's weighed in and given a personal opinion on tariffs, which, by the way, is incorrect. And I'm looking forward to next year when his term is up and President Trump puts somebody in there who actually knows how to steer the Federal Reserve in the right direction.
In a news conference about the decision to hold rates steady, Chairman Powell highlighted concerns that President Trump's tariffs could spur higher inflation and unemployment. He added they are waiting to see hard economic data on the impact of the tariffs before making a move on interest rates. Ohio U.S. Senator John Husted joined an effort to repeal the federal estate tax, commonly known as the death tax, on family farms and small businesses. Husted says that tax can cripple family-run farms because it forces them to pay a tax for transferring property and other assets when a family member dies. In a statement, Husted said, Ohio's family small business owners and farmers spend a lifetime feeding and fueling our nation, and they often hope to pass down their businesses to the next generation. I'm supporting this bill to give hardworking families and farmers relief from the costly tax burden that makes it hard or even impossible for them to provide for our communities for generations. Senator Husted also threw his support behind a bill to safeguard the Hyde Amendment, which prevents federal tax dollars from funding abortions. The bill would make the Hyde Amendment permanent. Right now, Congress has to vote on the Hyde Amendment every year. In a statement, Husted said, I'm supporting this bill to make sure American taxpayers with sincere moral and religious pro-life beliefs are never forced to fund abortion. I'll continue to back solutions to support mothers and families and protect unborn children, end quote. The amendment was already the law of the land under the Biden administration. Now a look at how state leaders are trying to help Ohioans protect their money. At its peak in 2021, Ohioans were grappling with at least $220 billion owed on medical bills, and lawmakers say that number is only rising. New legislation is now on the table in Ohio. The goal is to ease that staggering burden of medical debt. 10TV's Bryn Caswell explains the newly proposed Ohio Medical Debt Fairness Act and what it could mean for families trying to stay afloat.
No one ever plans on getting sick. And because of that, lawmakers say this new legislation will create permanent protection for Ohioans at their most vulnerable.
But in 2010, cancer diagnosis was nowhere in our medical budget.
Sleepless nights, counting bills, made Rachel Doan's life a living nightmare while her son Luke battled cancer.
There was always that black cloud of, what if I don't make payments, what happens?
Her medical debt, crippling. Even 15 years later.
There are still some things on my credit report. There are still a few providers that I am paying.
Doan isn't alone. 7 in 10 Ohioans have or know someone with medical debt. This is why lawmakers introduced the Ohio Medical Debt Fairness Act. The bill proposes capping medical debt interest rates at 3% annually, blocking providers from reporting to credit agencies, and banning wage garnishment tied to medical bills.
This provision protects working people and ensures that illness doesn't spiral into poverty.
Lawmakers making it clear this bill does not eliminate medical debt.
You will have to still pay for it, but it provides those necessary guardrails so it doesn't ruin your credit.
Luke, now a survivor, requires ongoing care. Doan says she fears the debt will someday fall on him.
We know things can come up as well as emergencies, and I don't want him to avoid any type of medical care because he's concerned about his own medical debt.
The bill will now go to a committee for further review, and it could take weeks until it's signed into law. Bryn Caswell, 10TV News.
Utility prices also continue to go up, and if you're submetered, there's not much you can do about it. Submetering is when you pay your utility bill to a third-party company. It could mean you're missing out on consumer protections and money-saving programs. Now, lawmakers want to give the power back to the residents trapped in this unregulated industry. 10TV's Carla Rogner shows you how a new bill in the State House could protect your energy bills.
Legislators say Central Ohio is a hotspot for submetering, but these companies operate in what they called a legal gray area. This legislation looks to close that gap.
They're a third party. You have to go through other avenues in order, so there's nothing we can do.
David DeNegri has done his research about submetering companies after realizing he paid his electric bills to one a few years back.
When I got the first bill, because I was expecting to get AEP. And it wasn't. It was APL. It sounds similar, doesn't it? AEP, APL? I thought it did.
When DeNegri received a bill he thought was too high, he realized his options for resolving the issue were limited because he was submetered.
We're actually being treated as second-class citizens, right? Because we're not given the same due process.
Submetering companies are not bound by any of these same obligations, even though the service they provide is identical from the customer's point of view.
Representatives Sean Brennan and Tex Fisher want submetering companies to be regulated the same way public utilities are. Their bill would require submetering customers have protections that they're not promised now, including due process for disconnecting utilities, access to low-income energy programs, a process to dispute bills in front of the PUCO, and the ability to switch energy providers.
There is an entire class of people who are locked out of that competitive retail electric market, and those are customers who are submetered.
Ohio Consumers Council President Maureen Willis has been fighting for regulation for years.
Fought it at the PUCO, fought it at the courts, and now we're at, you know, the legislative level.
And why should people who are submetered care about this bill?
Well, they should care about this bill because they're now getting they're now unprotected, and they're getting charged for a service that is not the same service as the utilities provide.
She says for customers like Denegri, this legislation is long overdue.
Consumer beware.
Next, these legislators plan to meet with other utility companies to try and get them on board this bill. Reporting at the State House, Carla Rogner, 10 TV News.
Thank you, Carla.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, ESPN Columbus.